All right, you wee ball bags!
Oh, God, he's done it. He's
Welcome done it. To the referendum special Creighton Crowbar podcast, a.k.a. episode 60, recorded on the 16th of September, mere days before the results come in, and we forcibly repatriate Graham to the northern wilderness, and the Tories build a 700-foot wall out of poor people just the other side of Carlisle. I'm Marsh Davis, and joining me this evening to celebrate the imperiled union by talking about PC games, we have...
Putting the tart in tartan, Chris Thurston.
Hi.
Putting scotch in his belly, Tom Senior.
Hello, always.
And finally, our very own Bonnie Prince. The star player of the Hot Dukes, perhaps the hottest duke.
That's contested.
And our special guest, Matt Cox.
Hello.
Welcome, Matt.
Thank you.
It's nice that for this referendum special, we have none of the regular Scottish members of this podcast.
They've been out. That's it. They're gone.
That's gone.
Yeah, well, actually, by the time this comes out, they'll never be allowed back.
Yeah, indeed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there'll be
possibly
a passport check on the door.
Anyway, there's only one question this week, and that is, for how many billions shall we sell this podcast to Microsoft for?
At least 2.5. Although I found out, actually, while arguing in the pub about this last night, because I thought, well, I was trying to figure out what was the most audacious thing that Notch could buy with his probably $1.77 billion. And I wanted to reach beyond private jet, so I went to aircraft carrier. Because that seems like... I like the idea of him on his brand new, probably disarmed aircraft carrier, just floating around the world, entering Ludum Dare game jams, and shying away from success by hiding on a floating fortress. But actually, an aircraft carrier costs, a new one, costs about $28 billion. I found out by Googling it in the pub. So, really, he has to step up his game a bit if that's his dream. And I don't know if that is his dream. I've kind of imposed that upon him. But in the event that that was what he was going for, then he needs another 14 Minecrafts, at least, if he wants an aircraft carrier of any stature.
Blimey.
But with that in mind, I don't think we would sell this podcast to Microsoft for anything less than, let's say, $30 billion.
Right.
Just to put us comfortably, give us some contingency. In addition to simply, you know, we need more to be able to run that aircraft carrier for a
the
while.
The furnishings.
Yeah. Mm. Jets. And
imagine the acoustics.
On an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
Probably not great.
Yeah, but fuck it.
It'd be great. Like, no, I mean, that's the dream, right? That is why any of us are doing
this. Yeah, that is very true.
It's all about the aircraft carrier.
Microsoft take note.
You'd need planes for the plane.
Is it an aircraft carrier if you can't afford any aircraft?
You can still carry them.
You can. Hmm.
Because we're not an era-defining PC game.
But you're not.
Four blokes.
Well, he was just one man.
He was just one man, but the thing he made was more than one man. It mattered to more than one man. It mattered to many men.
It mattered to many men.
And
many, many men.
Do you have opinions on whether it was good, bad?
Do I?
You know? Like, that seems to have been... It seems to have been quite a good reaction compared to normal internet shitstorms.
I think the internet's worn out of its tantrum and it's just kind of on the verge of falling asleep. So
yeah, it's a good time to bury bad news is after the internet has had to take an angry nap.
Yeah, precisely.
But I think it's... I mean, I fully respect Notch's decision. Like, I think his reasoning for wanting to leave, to wanting to move on, do other things makes complete sense. I don't know whether selling to Microsoft is the only option available to him in that scenario. And I get that they offered him a fuck ton of money. But at the same time, I think it was Tom Francis who was saying this, that he could have just left.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever. There's, whether or not Microsoft is the right company for that game and that audience remains to be seen. But there's an enormous amount of historical precedent that would say, maybe not. For example, Rare.
Yeah, Rare never made an epochal platform / game. Though,
no, but very few companies do. But I mean,
What I'm saying is, it's not like they're buying up an independent game developer. That's not what they're doing. They're buying up an entire platform which has touched the lives of nearly every child in the entire world, it seems.
Yeah, and we're putting that power in the hands of the people who make games for Windows Live.
Yeah.
If only Bulma was still around. Because that's the clash of...
I don't think anybody has ever said that until right now.
No, I do miss him.
The first time in human history.
If only he was there to bound onto stage E3 next year when they announced that Minecraft 2 is going to be Xbox exclusive or whatever. Bellow it. And a horrified crowd. I miss him. I really do. His energy, his enthusiasm, his... possibly being a Koopa Troopa from the live-action Mario Brothers movie.
Aww.
I think Minecraft is just kind of out there now, though. I mean, there's no way that Microsoft can restrict what Minecraft is, because people could just set up their own servers so easily.
Yeah, yeah.
I think surely it will be a sequel or something they build on top of it afterwards that they will completely own, and that's how they'll make their millions back, billions back, in fact. And as someone put it, Ben Cacera, I think, said that they're buying an entire childhood, basically. They're buying the childhood of their future audience by buying Minecraft and putting themselves, the big Microsoft logo, in the middle of that.
Mm. Well, they could certainly change their image, even if... It could change Minecraft's image, even if they don't end up changing the actual game.
It's powerful enough to change Microsoft's image. Well, they're quite a boring tech company at the moment to most young people. And if they become the people in control of Minecraft, then they could become, like, you know, a big happy name in their lives, big happy brand.
Maybe. But this is Microsoft we're talking about. And this is the thing, like, from a purely business point of view, yes, that makes complete sense. Who wouldn't want to own all children?
Yes, that's what...
But from a company history point of view, like, not the best track record. That said, there are smart things they could do, like bundling Minecraft with Windows from now on. That would be mega smart.
Yeah.
Like, because then when people get new PCs and they're getting it especially for to play Minecraft, it just makes sense to get.
Mm.
Yeah, I would honestly just bundle it with Xboxes and PCs from now on till forever.
Mm.
You do. Sell Master Chief hats.
You'd do a cheap kind of EE PC that can run Minecraft, just about, and sell that as a package, couldn't you, for tickets? I mean, sorts of stuff they could do with it. I think it's kind of sad, because I think Minecraft is epitomises what's great about the PC as a platform in terms of its openness, in terms of... I really respect Mojang for how open they've been with allowing people to fuck with it and mod it and turn it into their own thing. And they've kind of shepherded that culture. They've allowed it to grow and they've kind of nurtured it, rather than stamping restrictions on it or making it subscription or, you know, here's a paid-for expansion pack that you have to buy in order to get these blocks, which is the sort of thing that you could imagine a greedier company starting to do. And, you know, it's kind of hard to imagine Microsoft not doing that, really.
Well, I mean, Mojang is a small company as well, so 30 people.
Yeah.
And they've always had a fairly loose approach to management in terms of, like, how they respond to things. And how, you know, there's always been very personal, the kinds of responses whenever there's been an issue with Minecraft or something. And... that's not the kind of company Microsoft is. It's now entering an ecosystem of, you know, managers with a certain amount of, you know, like, a certain churn rate in the people involved and a lot of departments that will probably be involved in any decision. Because that's how any big company works. And previously the game probably didn't have to contend with, like, you know, marketing twats A through C every time anyone wanted to do anything.
Yeah,
you can. And now, at the very least, even if they make correct decisions, they'll be correct decisions under duress.
Yeah, this paints a little bit of a bleak future for Minecraft. But I don't think it'll change what Minecraft is now. I think kids will still have free access to Minecraft and the adventure worlds they've got access to and all the YouTube shows they love watching that are based on Minecraft.
I don't know how bleak a future it is. I mean, the reason that Microsoft have bought this is so that they have that kind of positive mindshare with every child in the world.
Mm.
And as soon as they start dicking with that, like, they've completely undone their reason for that purchase. And then some, I'd say.
Does that sound out of character for Microsoft?
No, it sounds exactly like the kind of stupid thing Microsoft would do, but, you know.
This is what I'm saying. They should rename the company Minecraft.
Very good.
Then we
should be the Crate and Microbarsoft when they buy us.
Yeah. Yeah, that. Why would they buy us? To gain mindshare with...
Same thing, yeah.
Four men.
Yes. Very lucrative.
Sometimes five.
What have you guys been playing? What have you been playing, Matt?
I've been playing Minimum, which is a third-person shooter with MOBA elements.
Is that the one that's quite blocky?
Yes. It's a minimalistic art style, which, yeah.
That answers the name of the game. Does have the problem of ungooglable names.
Yes. Yeah.
Minimum game you really can't search for.
Nope.
How have you found it?
It's okay. So it's an interesting idea. It takes MOBA elements, but it's not a full MOBA in any way at all. Like, so each team has a big robot, like a giant robot, which walks down, it's not really a lane, but they each walk a set path, like, down to the middle of the map until they meet, and then they start hitting each other, and they keep hitting each other until one of them falls over, and then that one carries on. And the idea is you get your robot to the hub of the enemy team, and then you've won. And there are, like, walls in the way that only he destroys, and turrets that players can destroy that are attacking the robot and all that. Which is... it's exciting. Like, watching two robots fight is just... sort of unavoidably great.
I mean, they're not... they are AI-controlled robots.
Yes, but, I mean, that's a stretch. They're just walking.
Right, okay. Like, yes, yeah.
There's not much to them. It's they're following a set path.
But you can't control them yourself, then, at any point? No, okay.
The way you do interact with them is basically... so, players can do some damage to the robot itself, because otherwise it would never fall over once the other robot was dead. So once both the robots are dead, there it goes into, like, this separate phase in which creeps, or, you know, little minions that are neutral and don't attack anything, like, scurry out of the walls, and you kill them and collect Titan charges, which make your Titan stronger the next time it appears.
Right.
And so the idea is, it's a bit like
Titanfall.
Yeah, very much like Titanfall with the robots. That's cleaning up.
They are called Titans, aren't they?
Yeah, they are called Titans. And there's even an achievement for destroying Titans yourselves, which is called Titans Fall.
Right.
Yeah.
See what they've done there. Yeah. That's good.
But it also reminded me of that
Heroes of the Storm.
Yes, the Heroes of the Storm map in which you collect various things.
And the one where you collect skulls to power up your golem.
It's that.
Okay.
That the game.
So it's a shooter, right?
It's a third-person shooter, yeah. And, I mean, actually, the shooting itself isn't brilliant. People don't react properly when you shoot them, because the art style, it's really stylized, and everybody is just like a collection of blocks. And when you shoot them, they don't really flinch or anything, they just start glowing. And when, like, someone keeps glowing loads until...
They die.
He glowed to death.
Well, yeah, which is quite... It's nice in a way, because, like, when you're really low on health, you're this big, glowing, like, everybody shoot me, which is quite intense, it's kind of fun. But at the same time, when there's no other reaction, it's a bit that. And it doesn't help that nearly all the weapons are, like, lasery things, which never have as much.
It needs the Team Fortress ding, then, doesn't it?
It does need the Team Fortress ding.
I got the same problem with Hawken, actually, which is much prettier. Well, it's a different art style, really, but, you know, even then it was, you know, bullet sponge robots that just don't react or spark or do anything or flinch. And if it's supposed to be a shooter at heart, that's really what you're doing moment to moment, then it probably should sell that shit a bit better.
Yeah. Get some flambeer on that shit.
Yeah.
That's what they need.
We talked about that earlier as well. Like, but it is a genuine, it's probably the first thing a shooter needs to get right. Like, and if you don't get that right, then a lot of the rest of the vocabulary of those games doesn't really work, because it's like, it has to be nice to shoot the gun at the man.
What does redeem it to some extent is, you have this loadout system, obviously, where you've got two weapons, and those are, you know, there are, like, laser rifles, sniper rifles, katanas, which are, they're quite fun and different. But, what makes it interesting is that they all have, like, a sub-ability. Like, on right-click, a shotgun might, blast you into the air loads, or make you dash forward, or one of them stuns, or something like that. Which is quite nice, because it means you can, like, combine various different things in interesting ways. So, like, I had, like, a sniper rifle combined with that shotgun, which let me, like, launch up into high places where I'd be able to snipe from and stuff like that. And, like, there's a shotgun that makes you passively go much faster. And then you can do that and combine it with a katana to get into people's faces.
I like the sound of that. That sounds good. Is it balanced? Hang on, is this out, actually?
It just came out.
Ah, so it's not early access, it's actually a full...
Yeah, no.
Release now. Okay.
It is annoying that bits of it are still, like, warden off, and, like, there's loads of, coming soon things on it, which are annoying, like, cause actually, the other big thing about it is its crafting thing, where... So you're collecting resources over the map from mainly destroying minions, but also killing players as well. And, on top of the weapon thing, you make armor for yourself each game. And most of those are like, stat increases and stuff, but some of them are more, like, do more damage, but take more damage yourself, stuff like that. Or do more damage from behind, or when crouching and stuff. But some of them are more interesting, like there's one that adds double jump. And I just built the thing that let me have double jump. stuff and tools.
You keep that between missions?
No, that's inside each game. Okay. So you start with like 10 armor points, which you put into the first upgrade of whatever you want, and then from there, you collect them up. The other really key thing to it, which I'm still not sure about, is that the way weapons level up as you go as well. So in each life, your weapon starts out mediocre, like fairly rubbish, and it gets much better by collecting the things that players drop when they die.
Yeah. Right.
But it's to the extent where, like, if you haven't killed anybody, your guns will be doing, like, 5 times less damage than the other person's.
Huh. Hmm. But I suppose it disincentivizes you from doing suicide runs.
It does. I mean, on one hand, it's an interesting, you know, risk-reward thing. But on the other hand, it's the old, like, give the player that it can do well things that can do even better.
Hmm.
How's the MOBA-esque aspect of this work? Is it, like...
So, it is interesting, but it doesn't mix it up as much as maybe you'd think, or maybe you'd want it to. Like, what I found is it focuses it in a really similar way to, like, capture points or the payload. It's most similar to, like, payload maps on TF2, but if the payload was a giant robot that went to fight another payload.
But it's still fun. It's functionally a mine car anyway, so yeah. Like, yeah. Huh. That makes sense.
Oh, that's a shame. That's a shame. I was thinking of downloading that, because I think... I'm sure it advertised being able to fight as giant robots in it, or in a giant mech suit or something like that.
No. You are thinking of Titanfall.
It's worth giving a go. Like, it's interesting enough. I just don't...
Sounds like they've got possibly too much going on, actually, with the different loadouts and the crafting and noble elements, you know. It's a lot of stuff to balance.
Possible. It does... I don't know if I found that, because it does trickle them in quite slowly. Like, you have to earn the... Like, you have to probably play about 5 matches before you earn a new weapon, which takes a reasonable length of time. And you only do that if you complete these special challenges, which are normally just something like... kill 10 people with X weapon or whatever. But infuriatingly, one time, that's like server side. And so when that happened and it glitched and stuff, and I completed like 2 of them in one thing, and it glitched out and my reward just wasn't there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's weird, because the way it's balanced is that those actually get you way more than doing like other stuff does. Like, those will catapult you towards the other stuff. But, what kind of happened for me was because those glitched out and all the rest were like, get 10 kills with this weapon you haven't bought yet, it seemed weirdly balanced that I would have to play like 10 times the length of time I would have done otherwise.
Mm.
Which is maybe an oversight.
It's mega cheap, isn't it? Is it? Is it?
Don't know.
Is it?
I could look it up. If you carry on that sentence long enough, it'll be seamless.
Is it?
Is it?
Could it be? I think it's probably about £6.
I think it's £6.
I think it's currently on sale, but it's possibly £6. If only Martin was faster at this.
How much is it worth, would you say?
Live fact checking.
About £6.
Well, they might hit it right on the money.
Come on, search autocomplete.
It's £3.49.
And is that on sale?
It is, and it's usually £6.99.
Well, yes! £7. So.
£1 too much.
That's pretty. You know, that's a pretty low asking price for it.
It's worth checking out for that.
Yeah, okay.
Especially if it's going to grow, right?
Yes, it does seem like it... Yeah, they're definitely going to add to it. It's annoying I'm a bit annoyed they've taken it out of early access with all of the coming soon signs plastered over it.
Right.
Hmm.
But, yeah, check it out for that. You'll get your money's worth before you run out of stuff.
Christopher?
Hello, Martin.
What have you been playing?
Well, I haven't been here for like 3 weeks, so I've played a lot of things in that time. But the thing I think I'm going to talk about, because it kind of relates to something similar, I've been replaying Wolfenstein The New Order.
Oh, yeah.
And which is a game I liked a lot. I think it's pretty great, probably best single-player shooter campaign this year. I don't know how much competition it has for that, really, but it's very good. But replaying it... has been a kind of... It's been interesting going back and realising just, like, how great that game feels. Like, if we're coming from a shooter that suffers for not really, like, selling the impact of anything you do. Wolfenstein is basically just, like... It's kind of amazing considering it's, like... You know, the Darkness was a first-person shooter, but it was a lot more about kind of powers that are explicitly going to be impactful because they are tentacles that impale people. Whereas Wolfenstein manages to give you a similar sense of, like, fucking things up in the world with the smallest guns that it has. And its guns get really, really, really big over the course of that campaign. And it's been, like, playing on the hardest setting particularly, which is supposed to be sort of very, very, very lethal. And there's, it's really well balanced, so the enemies don't really take very many more hits than they do normally, but you take, hardly any to take down. So it's more even footing with your enemies. And it made me appreciate just how many kind of like amazing little decisions go into the construction of just a fighting model, basically, in that game. So, you know, for the free lean is one of them, like the free kind of leaning up and down and peeking around corners is kind of essential. But it's got, and it's funny, the small things really make a shooter, but it's got the biggest, like, difference in momentum between running and sprinting I can think of in a shooter. And it's something that didn't occur to me the first time I played it, but I really noticed it the second time, because...
Do you mean momentum rather than speed?
Well, speed, but the feeling being of kind of pace and sudden, like, picking up of, like momentum that allows you to barrel into people.
Right.
Which is kind of a hard effect to have in a shooter, because you're kind of used to running supernaturally fast in, like, almost any shooter. And you're still fast, normally, if you're running. But the sprint is just sort of extraordinarily quick. And, like, the way... I found myself using melee a lot more. Like, using the knife a lot more. Because if you get behind someone, you can do, like, a stealth takedown. But it also has, like, variants on that. So if you run directly at someone and they don't see you till, like, the last minute, you still get to do, like, a front takedown or, like, a side takedown with the knife if you're kind of time it right. And it creates this amazing feeling of choreographing moments from an action film, right? Like the moment where the door barrels open and BJ Blazkowicz just sort of full-on punches a Nazi in the face and then stabs him in the neck. Like, it's really good at creating that cinematic sense of sort of violent action happening really abruptly then being over quickly because everything is so lethal. I don't know. Like, I appreciated it the first time I played it as this kind of, like, big, bombastic, silly corridor shooter with really great presentation. But the second time, I'm kind of appreciating just how good it is at maintaining that effect over time. Like, it sort of never really misses a trick in terms of feedback, which is rare, I think. Like, or even if it's just the impact on the environment of you spraying bullets around, things crumble really, really nicely. It's still a game where you gun down Nazi dogs, primarily, but it's, yeah, it's really, really well executed. And I also interviewed Jen Matisse, who's the creative director of it, on Friday. For something else, I'm working on a piece of game at the moment. And that conversation was not really about that, but it spoke to their general interest in making you feel involved in the world, and given that the primary verb in FPS is shoot the gun at the man, as we were saying, it's evident how much care was spent on making that feel good, which I think is a form of artistry in games that maybe gets deprecated when you're talking about artistry in games, because it is the artistry of making a Nazi fall over in a way that's fun. Which is not like any of the high forms of art, as far as I remember.
Yeah, I don't remember front row picking on that as a particular accolade in opera, for example.
But it is actually operatic. Like, I think that's the thing about it. And
to be honest, that's a particularly good word to use for its narrative, because it operates at exactly that kind of histrionic level.
Yeah,
that opera
but this is well, I mean, so I've had this argument for ages that it's the same with action films that, like, this is probably the most Christensen thing I'm ever going to say, but action films and musicals have a shitload in common. But if you just replace fights with songs, like, they're structured in a way to kind of, like...
Then the world would be a happier place.
Yeah, indeed. But, you know, sort of certain kinds of, like, martial arts films and things are structured in a way that you have, like, a plot, 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 character explaining fight.
Right, yeah.
And, like, musicals are plot, 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 character explaining song. Where the plot maybe doesn't advance during the song, but it's basically there to go, like, look at this guy for a bit. And games are similar, and yeah, it has that kind of, absurdist kind of approach to storytelling that, the opera does as well. And that was part of the nature of the conversation I had, which was interesting, which was, making a game that is deliberately discordant. Because, you know, we talk about it and we have string when we say it, but, you know, ludonarrative dissonance is something that is easy to pick on drink. It's easy to pick on, but it's also like a legit creative choice sometimes. And one of the interesting things from that discussion was that you know, they deliberately wanted to make a game where one minute you are jumping from the wing of one stricken plane to the wing of another stricken plane, then you fight a big dog, then you fight a man whose name is literally Death's Head, and then a plane crashes into your face, and then you crash a space shuttle, and then, but it's also a game where you spend a short sequence carrying a wobbly tray of coffee.
Hmm.
Like, it has absurd domestic elements alongside its kind of total, like, Nazis on the moon ridiculousness.
Because we were talking about this in the pub, and we were both saying that collision of different things was nonetheless effective.
Yeah.
In fact, absurd is possibly... I mean, it feels like it should be absurd, but actually, those two things can be consumed and compartmentalised and analysed separately and, you know, on their own merits. I wonder if actually, going back to the opera analogy, you know, when people say, oh, isn't it ridiculous that Nico is meant to be this sensitive soul, but then he's engaged in a gun battle with, you know, so many people. Maybe that's the same as saying, well, this guy's wife has just died and now he's singing in opera.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, people are able to separate the two experiences. And
I think, and this is maybe a broader point, but I do think that, like, critical approaches to shooters or violent games generally suffer for kind of arriving with a lot of kind of prepackaged notions. Like, it feels like as that genre gets more familiar and as it becomes more and more like the genre that matters commercially to people, the willingness to actually kind of pick apart the small details of that and not just say, oh, it's another big, silly, brawny shooter, gets kind of... Well, it gets harder to find. People are still doing it.
It is a big, silly, brawny shooter, but it's an exquisitely made...
Yeah, but that has value, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And also, it can still have something to say. Maybe not something significant. I mean, its thesis is basically that Nazis are awful, and maybe you should shoot them. but there is something to that. Like, that's not very much more elaborate than the thesis of Inglourious Basterds.
No, really. I think both of those games take pop cultural revenge on
history.
Yeah, history. I think that's quite an interesting thing to do.
It is. But yeah, like that's, and I don't know, it's sort of, it made me, partly the craft of the game, so the thing I started talking about, the feel of it, just how like meticulously and exquisitely constructed all of its sounds and visuals are. But also that sense of the developers owning the fact that, yeah, it's a bit absurd. That you're not necessarily being clever if you go, oh, this is ridiculous, like, it's trying to make me... Because the way to write it off is to go, like, oh, it wants me to care about this character, but 2 minutes ago I was firing two shotguns from the hip and a Nazi blew up. And, like, I think you need to take it, like, an extra step, like, when you think about games like this. You have to actually go, like, well, is that moment of, like, suddenly being dunked in cold water after this other experience the effect that the developers actually want to have? Maybe they are going for a mood rather than...
When it comes to the craft of... creating weapons for first-person shooters. I do worry sometimes that will be lost in our procedurally generated future of endless Destiny weapons or Borderlands weapons and that kind of thing. Whereas, you know, in Borderlands especially, it felt like a freak accident that I'd found something that felt good, like some confluence of, you know, dice rolls had produced a good weapon. Whereas in something like Wolfenstein, they're all fucking good weapons because they've been really carefully designed to be feel satisfying in different ways.
Nothing felt that good to me in Borderlands. I don't think I ever got that.
That's, I mean, and I'm not going to get drawn into talking about because we're a PC podcast, but that's the reason I don't like Borderlands and do like Destiny. It's because Destiny's guns feel good.
Okay.
And Borderlands is just generally known.
Yeah. Do we all dislike Borderlands then?
I don't dislike Borderlands, I've had fun.
Okay.
I still liked it. I didn't hate it, but
it was never a game that I could summon any enthusiasm for, really. Apart from, like, I mean, I liked some things about the world and the presentation and the, but like, I just didn't like the game.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Wolfenstein, which, I mean, yeah, basically, like, I think it's now approaching probably Steam sale territory, like Christmas sale or something, like, it's been out long enough and it's, I think, I gave it an 84, I think, in PC Gamer when I reviewed it, and I think that's probably about the right score for it. But, like, the even playing it again a couple of months later, it stands up as, like, probably one of the year's best single-player games because it is legit great. And if you liked first-person shooters in the noughties, in, like, the immediately post-Half-Life 2 era of first-person shooters on PC, then it's the best one of those probably since that era.
Impressed they did it with that engine as well, after playing Rage.
Yeah.
And it's impressive to see what Wolfenstein gets right that Rage doesn't respect its weapons and environments.
Well, Rage got a lot wrong.
Sure did.
Yeah. Wolfenstein does not have buggy racing or a dice rolling game.
Yeah.
Yeah!
What have you been playing, Marty?
I've been playing two things, but one of them's good, one of them's not very good, but probably has more interesting things to say about. So, good thing, it's Mini Metro, which is in early access at the moment. It's kind of a score attack puzzle game, based around the tube maps that you find, all designed by... I just looked up his name again. Forget the name of the designer. It's Harry Beck, you know, the kind of archetypal tube map designer. And you start with, you kind of load up a map. It says London, you've got a river designed like a tube map, and then stations start popping up over it. Each of the stations is a different kind of shape, and different passengers appear next to the station, so they want to go to another station of a different shape. So you draw lines between the different stations, and obviously a railway network grows from that. But you're under constant restrictions, and you have to survive a certain number of weeks in order to gain new tracks and be able to put new carriages on the trains, add new trains to the tracks, be able to put more tunnels underneath the river, for example, things like that. And as it goes on, you actually begin to have a real appreciation for transport and for the ways, the kind of pressures and resource problems that transport systems actually face. And you realise that actually the reason that there is a circle line and that it's bisected in different compass point directions by other lines is not an accident. That's really useful for people to get from one end of the map to the other. And, it's quite surprising. I'm really shit at it. I'm still better than Alec Mir, so that's a small consolation. I've got this leaderboard in it. Apparently, there's only a few levels at the moment, but it's going to grow. It's in early access, so it's £4 or something.
Graham spoke about it on the podcast a long time ago when it was on Greenlight and maybe when it was a browser game.
I did wonder about that. It did ring a bell, but I couldn't find it.
I don't think you're on that podcast. Because I remember it being one that we recorded elsewhere. But has it, as a standalone game, as a early access game, do you feel like it's shed its sort of browser origins, or does it still feel...
Well, it's quite a simple interface, and it's very clean and beautiful, and I don't know how, there wouldn't be any value in making that complex enough for it to not feel like it could be played in a browser, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure.
It's very slick, it's very smooth. They're going to get music by Disaster Piece at some point. There's no sound in the game currently, which is actually surprisingly problematic, I think, because there's a lot of feedback for things when a station is getting overcrowded. You want to be able to... there's obviously oral kind of hints that are going to occur at some point, and there aren't those at the moment. But, yeah, it's a very interesting game. Really worth playing and getting horribly addicted to.
So what didn't you like?
I didn't like SteamWorld Dig.
Okay.
SteamWorld Dick, more like.
XP.
Which is one of the games that was in the Humble Bundle with... what's that other game? Noir Point, something like that. Anyway, last week. I had it recommended to me by Alex Fulcher, who said it was great, and he's totally wrong about that. But in this game, Sidon game, you are a robot in the future, and you have to, you get bequeathed a mine, and you dig stuff from the mine.
Can robots inherit things?
You have a robot uncle. I don't know quite how that system of procreation works. I don't particularly want to know.
It's more like Steamy World Dig.
And that's really all there is to it. You just dig and dig and dig. And you're occasionally rewarded with better tools to dig with. And at no point, I've been playing it for some hours now, at no point has it ever suggested that there is a greater design to this or some actual reason that you would want to be able to do this stuff, other than to carry on digging and earning more stuff.
Falling down the goddess hole again.
Well, I hadn't thought of that comparison, but there's quite a lot of similarities. But I was kvetching to Tom in the pub about this, and... I don't know what this... Like, the other games have solved the problems that it has. It makes a lot of problems with ways of incentivizing you to keep on playing. So you hit a block, it takes you maybe 4 or 5 boring hits to actually break it up and move on, collect whatever else you need to do. And after you've earned a certain amount of money from collecting gold and stuff in the mines, you can spend it on a pick that allows you to destroy that block in 2 hits. But then you get onto another strata of rock, which is... 4 hits again with that new pick. And so it goes. You just keep on earning picks and then having that advantage taken away from you. I just don't see...
Is it a metaphor?
for not having enough things to do in your life?
Yes.
Right. Could be. I don't know. I don't really... I, I don't want to play another game where I have to hit anything more than once. Ever. Like, I'm bored of that now. I know where that goes. Like, I can imagine hitting it another three times. You don't need to make me do it. But, I was thinking there must be other ways of just rewarding the player with progress that isn't just so kind of insular or inward looking.
I was like, what I see in the pub was, does it feel good to hit things? Like, it's, that could be satisfying enough if the crunch of...
It's all about feel, man.
Smashing something is satisfying in itself.
No, not really.
Yeah, yeah. That's where it's fallen down.
But don't all games have that to an extent, though? Hmm. Like, to go into Wolfenstein, you own a gun at the beginning that can take out Nazis in two hits, and then you get a bigger gun that takes a man one hit, and then they get a bigger Nazi.
So I'm wearing helmet.
He takes two hits.
But then the actual act of shooting the Nazis is inherently entertaining, yeah, whereas the act of hitting the block isn't.
No,
so yeah, you're totally right, there is that.
I'm not historically angry at the block.
Yeah.
But also there...
the block has committed no atrocities. There's no revenge thriller there.
Yeah.
Would it help if the blocks were Hitler?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'd play that game.
Solved.
Mm. Do you think you could easily, like, what if it would take four hits normally, and then there was, like, a small bit where you targeted it, and if you hit that little bit, precision digging, it took one.
Oh, you see. Fortnite tried to do this.
Oh, really?
Where it adds critical hit points to the thing you're pointlessly smacking. And that game's not out yet, so it's a bit unfair to they could change it easily. But that does not make it any more fun. In fact, it just makes it more annoying, because you have to pay... give more attention to this pointless menial task than you would otherwise. You could kind of do it mindlessly.
Yeah.
The difference is between the bigger guns, bigger Nazis analogy is that it would be the same thing if you used the same gun to kill the same Nazi and the same thing, it just continued for the rest of the game. And you didn't get a bigger gun, you just got a gun that did bigger numbers and the Nazis' numbers got bigger.
Okay.
You know, the reason that it's good to have progress in shooters is because usually there is some kind of change in the way that you're approaching problems. You know, that's why it introduces Nazis with different kind of tactical machine dogs and things at their behest. Mm. You know, that's,
it does introduce electro-Nazis, steam Nazis, orange steam Nazis, and moon Nazis.
Also, there's a huge element of interacting with space in order to get into position to not be hit and then also get the hit, and that is a skill game.
Yeah, there's a degree of some part of your brain is functioning rather than just
it's actually doing far more.
Yeah. The trajectory isn't just simply it gets harder and you get better weapons.
What if destroying every block took you into a mini game where you had to kill a Nazi?
Yeah, I can see that as well. I can see. So you kill Hitler and then you get a Nazi killing mini game.
Yes.
For each block. Right.
But all the blocks are also Hitler?
Yes.
Solved.
Perfect. Yes. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, we either ruined or fixed that game.
It seems like they've just misapprehended the appeal of playing games.
That's pretty much the worst problem you can have.
Didn't you say it was, wasn't it originally a mobile game of some kind? Or a
I think it was on
game?
3DS.
It was really popular on DS, wasn't it?
See,
I think it really took off.
I said this a while in the pub, but it sounds like something that's designed to be inherently rewarding in 5-minute bursts on a train.
When you have a touchscreen.
Yeah, where there's that tactile element to it as well. Whereas, you know, when it's transported onto a PC monitor and you're sitting there giving it all your attention, maybe that's where it
fits. Yeah, maybe you spend 5 minutes on it, you get some kind of arbitrary measure of progress which actually affects nothing in terms of the dynamic of the game, and then you feel better about your commute.
Yeah.
But sitting here in front of my PC trying to enjoy it for a span of half an hour and really not, it doesn't work.
No.
I was wondering what else they could do with that. I mean, other games have had this digging mechanic, and there's an element of kind of exciting exploration involved, particularly in games which are procedurally generated, like Terraria and things like that. Yeah. And, you know, that's an exciting kind of impulse in itself to explore. And this game doesn't really have that. It's just downwards. Downwards forever.
I could talk about possibly pointless progression mechanics that you eventually see through and start to slowly despair over.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the last couple of weeks, I reviewed The Sims 4, which is, I guess, the other new thing I played. The thing about The Sims, to briefly introduce the game and its genuine strengths, it makes a much better job of simulating the Sims and their moods and their actions at a kind of individual level, giving them internal lives in a way that they haven't had before. The design tools are better, all that stuff's great. Neighbourhoods are smaller, but after a certain point I didn't mind so much. I understand that the internet mines a huge amount. But I didn't mind after 20 hours with it. It didn't register as much. But otherwise, it is the same game as The Sims 3, minus a couple of features and plus a couple of different ones. When I say it's the same game, it is still a time management game about making sure that a lot of bars are green at the right time in a Sim's life for them to get a promotion at work. That isn't very hard. Like, if you, there's a lot of fun to be had in The Sims deliberately fucking things up and deliberately kind of torturing people or whatever. But there is also a tremendous draw to The Sims, which is actually making things nice for people. Like, I think maybe, unless you're dispositionally inclined to only derive fun from boxing people into little rooms and watching them shit themselves to death, then there is something to be said for the wish fulfillment aspect of The Sims, which is just like, I'm going to make this little guy's life brilliant. And that leads naturally to what I think most people do, which is make some sort of analogue for themselves and then give themselves the life they secretly want. And it's perfect. That is the draw of the game. It is the kind of like make yourself thing. And I was talking to Andy Kelly at PC Gamer about this because he'd never played a Sims game before this one. And he started off experimenting and doing very Andy Kelly things like locking a man in a room, torturing him to death. And he lost apparently like 6 hours to it the night before we recorded this, getting drawn into the other side, the kind of wish fulfillment, what if I was a novelist kind of thing. And because it is this real draw, and but the thing is, but the game is so trivially easy that you fulfill one set of requirements, you get your promotion, you get a new novel out there or whatever, you meet somebody, and then you get a slightly harder set of requirements and you fill them, but it's never hard. So the only thing that's required of you is just to be efficient for a long time. Just sit in front of your computer and keep being efficient. And you plan little events in your head to make it meaningful. Like, you know, but on Saturday when he doesn't have work, I'm going to go to the park. I'm going to make a new friend. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to have a house party. I'm going to expand my house. All the rest of this stuff. And you fill their little lives with this stuff and their downtime. But the rest of it's just like hitting the criteria. And then you fulfill their lifetime ambitions, which gives you like special powers and furniture and stuff. And you kind of won the game at that point. But then, inexorably, without you really wanting to, they just get older. And so while you're kind of the only real, like, the only time the game ever has a sting in its tail, while you're just sort of, like, is breaking blocks, you're just blithely kind of marching through a series of pretty trivially easy tasks in pursuit of just sort of more of that, but with greater status attached to it, which is the same as any kind of block progression mechanic. The only difference is that you get to a point where your sim goes from being a young adult to being an adult. And you have to throw them a birthday party or they get depressed. And then they turn into adults. And then they get even older and you have this clock that's ever taking like 17 days till elder. And then you go grey and stooped and fat. And it's like, oh man, what have I done with my life? And then, you know, you hurriedly get married, produce offspring and don't have a household to sustain past you. And then the green root becomes, and no one really gives a shit that you were a great novelist or whatever, because no one in the world gives a shit about you, really, and your achievements mean nothing because they occurred in a challengeless vacuum.
Are we still talking about The Sims?
Are we? And that was that went to a place I didn't know it was going to go, really. But that was my experience of The Sims, and that's always been my experience of The Sims, actually. Like, meanwhile, someone plays the spoons.
Why is there a child just repeatedly banging a piece of metal outside our window? Why don't you...
It's the fucking cat summoning.
Blame Minecraft for your shit.
What an asshole.
But the thing is, Marsh, much as in The Sims, that person is going to get inexorably older and die.
Yay! Well, small consolations, I suppose.
Yeah, but anyway, the reason I brought up mortality was because there is something nonetheless really satisfying about just sort of like tapping those blocks for a day, just like watching the little guy's life get better. And there's no game satisfaction to be gleaned from it, to the extent that if you try and like game The Sims, like creating perfect houses or like exploiting game mechanics to give you loads of money without cheating or what, all that stuff, you feel like you've kind of broken the spell a bit, right? It's not really for that. It is for kind of like just happily rolling around in like a late capitalist Californian fantasy land that you don't really need to ever question. Like The Truman Show, but if you never left.
The thing I really like about The Sims, I think, is the way it airbrushes reality.
Yeah.
And just kind of the things it chooses to exclude completely, like homelessness and
Illness.
Illness, yeah.
That's illness doesn't exist. Like, yeah. People can get, like, temporarily, like, feel a bit poorly, but it's, like, a negative mood. Like, they can get a negative mood if they eat bad food. And it might, the mouse overness is, like, feeling a bit queasy and whatever, but it doesn't manifest in, like, long-term illness does not occur in that world.
Can you become a doctor?
No. Oh. It's not one of the jobs.
No, okay, it doesn't exist.
Then. Yeah, so, you know, it doesn't exist. Doctors don't exist, so illness doesn't exist. Like, The things it excludes are kind of...
It becomes quite an interesting shrink-wrapped vision of reality, and it's an interesting artifact because of that.
Yeah. Steps of wives-y.
Yeah.
Booze doesn't exist either.
Oh, really?
And I think it's because they're probably territories they couldn't sell it to kids in if it had drinking in it.
Okay.
So, even though learning to be a bartender is a skill, and nightclubs are in there, like, none of the drinks are named in a way that implies alcohol content, or presented in a way that implies alcohol content, and people can get drunk. Like, I've always liked The Sims, and I've always, like, I like its creative potential, I love its tools, like, I like that little fantasy you get to live out in it, and I even like going through the motions of playing it, even if I don't necessarily see a huge value in them from a game design point of view. But it is also a bit like the person you knew at uni or whatever, who had, like, a perfectly squeaky clean, wholesome, has every answer outlook on life, who you secretly want to see hammered. I don't know if that's just me, but that does a, you know, that urge to
ruin somebody's life,
break something beautiful.
Jesus,
that's probably the wrong way of putting it. It's so squeaky clean and so kind of wholesome that you want to mess it up, right? Like, you can dress up your characters as punks or whatever, but they can't go and smoke weed out the back and hate their parents, right? They can't hate their parents for more than 5 minutes because it's not allowed.
I just wish it was, I love that The Sims exists, but I wish it was like a genre populated by more than one game, really. I want to see lots of different outlooks on existence, modern existence.
There used to be more Sim games of that kind, didn't there? I remember when, you know, like Creatures was on the scene at the beginning of time, there seemed to be a spate of those kind of games, and now it seems not to be something that's explored.
Yeah, really. There was a crappy kind of naughty Sims, which wasn't The Sims, but it was quite a different developer that kind of...
Yeah.
About getting drunk and doing drugs and stuff.
That said, though, actually, with that in mind, there are moments of, like, charm and character in The New Sims, and it all comes through the emotional stuff. So, like, Woohoo, The Sims euphemism for banging, is no longer a kind of binary happy thing that happens to Sims. Like, it's always a good thing, but based on their mood going in, it can go well or badly. And so you can get, like, an amazing mood. Like, if you send, like, a flirty Sim to bed with an energized Sim, with the emotional state they're in, they can have spectacular woohoo, and they both feel amazing for like a day afterwards. But if you send like a really, really tired Sim to bed with a depressed Sim, they can have really, really bad woohoo, and just both be embarrassed afterwards and not want to talk to each other. And like, those little moments of like, someone with a bit of life experience, this is what I mean when I say like, I want to break their beautiful world. Like, someone with a bit of life experience kind of went in and sort of like painted over that bit and made it so that, and the animations are different for actually what happened in the bed, and the sounds are different based on how it's going. If they're talking more, it's generally gone a lot worse, which,
I'd love to see them put that on the back of the box, like, woohoo of shame added.
Apparently they removed it, but apparently woohoo is going to be a skill.
Oh, really?
It's going to be something you can be better or worse at. But they just changed it to having like, not random effect, like random outcomes, but like outcomes based on other criteria. Like,
okay.
So if everyone's happy and rested and feeling energized, then it goes well, and if they're not, then it doesn't.
Yeah.
But I like that insight into the designer's mind, right? That we,
sir, that's, what do you do, sir? I'm a master of woohoo.
Amazing how people probably would try and argue that. But that's nice, because that allows you to see sort of into the mind of the designer a bit, and it makes that world less sort of blithely perfect, right? Similarly, like, a confident Sim can pee like a champion. Enjoyed that one. Angry Sims can angrily poo.
It's kind of dark that you can see little cracks into the world there, isn't it?
It feels like sometimes, at its best, I think it feels like the jokes for adults that are left in Pixar movies. You know what I mean? When there's like a little winky nod to something, because...
Everything's shit, really.
Yeah. Just for all you grown-ups out there. Sometimes, even good things are terrible.
Sometimes, mortality.
Yeah, exactly. And then you die.
Yeah.
There was a great bug at launch, I don't know if they patched it out, which meant that once one person had died, all the other Sims counted as having met the Grim Reaper, and they could invite him to parties, potentially date him.
That's amazing.
Yeah. There's many good things about it. I don't necessarily think it's a worth the asking price, because it is very expensive, and it's so locked down by EA that they're probably never going to change that, because they don't have to, because it's the best-selling PC game of all time, the series, anyway.
I wonder if things like Andy Kelly's Room of Despair are reactions to the airbrush nature of the world it presents. Like, there's this, a feeling that you have to fuck it up in some way.
No, that's what I'm talking about, the urge to just fuck it up a bit. And like Alice and Kev as well, which was...
Yeah, I was about to mention Alice and Kev, actually, which is Robin Birkinshaw's fantastic diary, which he simulates homeless people. He just has people in The Sims 3, I think, who just don't have a house, and he sees what they do and diarises it.
One of the interesting things with The Sims 3, so before writing the review, I went to Sims Reddit and just said, like, hey, what do you guys want? Because I knew what I wanted from a sequel, but
yeah,
that game's got a very, very, very dedicated community, and I didn't want to make assumptions on their behalf, necessarily, or at least I wanted their input. And one guy pointed out that, like, he wanted the game to be harder, and one of the reasons he wanted it to be harder is that The Sims 3, one of the easiest ways to have, like, a perfect life was to be homeless. Like, a well-managed homeless sim didn't have to worry about bills and a lot of the stuff that... To the same extent that a home sim did, but there were enough facilities in the world, like gyms with showers and stuff like that, that were all free functionally, because that's the way the game world works. You can just go into buildings and use the items in that building. That you could have a perfectly happy sim with a job, locking down loads of money, who just didn't have a house, that just slept in random places and showered in the gym and ate in a restaurant every day. And that's the, I think, the extent of the game's failure to acknowledge that kind of a few things. Like, it's always that its simulation is more impressive than any other game trying to do this, but the things it misses make it not life, right? Like, that's the... And that's why it's good when you see these little glimpses into...
I mean, it's supposed to be comforting, isn't it? It's really...
That is the...
It's supposed to be comforting, but it'd be nice to see someone else attack that with a more mixed approach.
I suppose the reason I was trying to connect to the Seymour Dig is that you'd probably be more okay with that endless procession of bigger pickaxes if there was some other fantasy attached to that procession of events, right? Like, the reason I will persist with The Sims is because I want the beautiful modern house, like, and you know, the career success and the whatever, right? Like,
there's also agency in the decisions you're making.
Sure, yeah. And I'm setting my goal to an extent, even if the actions to achieve it are the same for writer as they would be for astronaut, because it's just different categories you've got to fill out.
And that creates anecdotes in a way that then I mind the red block.
That's very true.
Yeah, like, my sister used to love The Sims, and what she got out of it was home building. It was, like, people who love The Sims found ways to glitch The Sims 2 to add, you know, higher roofs and balconies and things, you know, things that weren't, you know, intentionally in there. Maxis didn't put that stuff in there, but, you know, they found ways to fuck up the system to make the house they wanted to make. And that's, like, let's not underestimate the urge to do that, like, how powerful that is as a fantasy and a rewarding thing. Cool, though. I look forward to playing it. Very much.
What have you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing Dawn of War.
Dawn of War?
First Dawn of War.
That's the first war, right?
It was the very first war. The Dawn
the
of Dawn.
Time. The Dawn of War.
Which is 12 years ago, according to Relic. Relic Entertainment is one of my favourite games companies, because they make some of my favourite examples of my favourite genre, which is the RTS genre, which is a little bit underserved these days, really. After the huge glut of Command & Conquer Dune 2 clones that we had, like, in the 90s. Command & Conquer, that's all gone now. But I still... Relic is still around. They're still making Company of Heroes 2. And I just wanted to kind of celebrate their first games and what they did for the genre, and why they were so fantastic, and why they're still worth revisiting today. And the first one is Homeworld, which is an RTS set entirely in space, which you control a mothership, which I think is trying to find its way...
Home,
yeah. Which is a world. And you can see how that whole came together. Homeworld is extremely difficult. It's one of the most difficult RTSs you can try to learn, because it actually genuinely happens in 3D space. And the leap from 2D sprites to 3D space, truly, in a strategic way, is, like, the mental leap that requires of you to position things is extraordinary. Mm. And that makes it extremely difficult. And it's got a very complex resource management system on top of that. The real genius of Homeworld is that the traditional Dune 2 model says you build bases, you mine spice, and then the bases make little things that do the war for you. Homeworld says the base is your war machine. The base is the mothership, which is this extraordinary, precious thing that can never be destroyed. It's like the last vestige of your culture. And at the same time, it's your greatest defensive weapon. And this philosophically informs everything that Relic have done with the RTS since, by putting things that you would normally defend in the most danger. So the mothership is this vast, beautiful kind of boomerang, space boomerang, that you, it moves extremely ponderous speeds, but can create extraordinarily beautiful frigates. And it's one of the most beautiful games I've ever played. I have to say Homeworld, because it's just...
yeah, it's lovely.
If you love space and nebulae and
And frigates.
And frigates and drive engines that
boomerangs. Leave
massive trails like through space, it's absolutely stunning. It also models combat like a series of different scales within itself. So the frigates can launch fighters, which are like swarms of bees that will kind of like buzz around enemy craft. And that's one scale. It's the microcraft, the individuals piloting those things are represented. Then it's these, the battles between the frigates themselves. Then there's the motherships and the vast ships you're fighting as well. And like, there's war happening in three dimensions on these three levels. And it's just a fantastic, fantastic strategy game, real-time strategy game. Hmm. It's demanding as fuck, but, both beautiful, serene. It's got, Adagio for Strings playing in the background. So you're kind of going about your war business.
So the three dimensions, I mean, that makes it good. I mean, maybe it doesn't compare, but I remember somebody was talking about Planetary Annihilation. I've forgotten who it was. And they were saying that, you know, the thing with Planetary Annihilation is you're fighting on a planet and it's not just a map, it's like, you know,
a sphere.
I was saying that myself, actually. Yeah. The difference is that actually Homeworld, the problem with Planetary Annihilation is that you don't have a back. There's no cliff behind you from which you can't be attacked. So you could be fucked from any angle, basically. Whereas in Homeworld, there are edges to the map. And you're coming from a position, like, you know where the battle lines will probably be, even if they're in three dimensions.
Okay.
You're not going to be suddenly attacked from behind in a way that you probably can't handle. And you're not being asked to build huge walls around yourself, because your base is the mobile thing, that your base is the thing that is moving into the combat, and you're kind of managing all the time. Mm. And this kind of continued with the Dawn of War, which is a Warhammer 40,000 game. Which is more traditional, top-down, isometric-y RTS. But they introduced for the first time the idea of capture points, where the resources weren't wasn't spice in the ground around your base, or these minerals that sit at the back of the map. The resource points are actually in the field, and you have to go and fight for them. And it's a bit like moving your big base forward in Homeworld. It's like you've got to move everything into those spaces. You've got to gamble. You've got to put things on the line in order to succeed. And it also forms battle lines, like draws. It's just really obvious design when you think about it, but it's never happened. It hadn't happened before that point. It had all been Dune 2. It had all been turtling. You build a big force and you roll it out, and you know, StarCraft 2, Command and Conquer. It was all the same in that respect, and they'd be painted differently. You'd have different sprites, but this actually changed the rule set and how that stuff was supposed to work. And it's fantastic. Even today, it's probably still worth going back to Dawn of War.
The first one,
yeah. Especially...
Not even the subsequent. Games or?
4-2 is a very different experiment, actually.
So I seem to remember, I played some of them, and I thought they were more kind of squad-based games rather than full-scale RTS games.
Well, you could have squads, like numerous squads, it's still an RTS game. Just because you're not commanding individuals. In fact, it's good that you're not commanding individuals. What that allows for is, it allows you to chunk them in your mind and have control of a larger army. By making these squads individual elements in your mind that you're controlling.
Hmm.
That was basically what it was for, is because they had the Warhammer IP, they wanted to realise the scale of that on, you know, old technology now. Like, what they did with it was very impressive for the time, and the way they allowed you to do that tactically was to make it about squads, about individual orders for groups of people, which was really effective.
Hmm. No, what I meant was, did the scale shrink down in subsequent Dawn of War games? So I seem to remember you commanding individual units in the latter ones.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, this Dawn of War 2 is a weird experiment where they kind of... I was talking to them earlier about this, actually, because it's the anniversary of the game, so especially some of the original designers on Dawn of War and Dawn of War 2, and they were playing Dota. Part of it was they were playing Dota, like the original Dota, the Warcraft 3 mod.
Hmm.
And looking at, because that's an RTS, really, from the way that Reddick would look at it.
Totally.
It's extraordinary combat.
5-on-5
action RTS,
where most of the time you control a single unit.
Yeah, absolutely.
But even then, not always. I mean,
not all the time.
Yeah.
And you played Dawn of War 2, and you can...
Anyone can buy a Necrobook. Sorry, I'm dumb.
It's okay. But you give your troops these limited moveset that ask you to micro them, and it's kind of, it's an element trying to fuse the RTS with Dota elements and also make it give you an RPG progression as well. But this was at a time where shooters were trying, a lot of genres were fusing basically and moving. You'd have things like Mass Effect that actually had proper shooter elements in it, an RPG with proper shooter attached, and then you had things like Dawn of War, which was an RTS with a proper RPG attached, and that's what happened to add a variation to those genres like 10 years ago. Mm. And now we just have a crazy genre mishmash, and all our terms are outdated. Well, we have a question on that, if I later on.
I love Homeworld.
Yeah, it's fucking amazing.
I mean, I know there's, like, they're making what, Shipbreakers now?
Yeah.
Which is the now, so, but I don't really understand how that's Homeworld, given it's terrestrial. It's like, and Homeworld is all about.
Yeah.
Like, however, Homeworld was also about beautiful space things, and it is possible for that game to be about beautiful space things.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is part of the deal.
I dearly love to see a modern Homeworld, like with the modern engine. Like, it looks astonishing even now, but like the stuff they could do with a scaling engine would be extraordinary.
The nice thing about that game, and you touched on it, but I think another effect of what you're talking about having your base be this thing that rolls forward into battle with you, is it creates, in addition to the three dimensions and the three levels of combat, it creates natural phases in battle as well, where other RTS games have that, but sometimes like the most exciting attack in a game is like the first one, where like, you know, the person's great big rush strat bashes into your defenses and you either repel it or you don't, and that determines a lot of the rest of what happens. The great thing about Homeworld is, because ultimately, like, in a multiplayer skirmish, for example, it's going to be two of these motherships, maybe from different factions, rolling towards each other very slowly, with the faster frigates and other ships going out in front of it. Like, you have those skirmishes, but then eventually at some point the motherships themselves come into play, and that always basically means that the climax of the match is going to happen towards the end, which is not always the case in other kinds of other kinds of strategy game.
No, it's not that you can't take that for granted at all.
It's like, I mean, it's narratively satisfying, even if the strategic level is also enhanced by it in a different way.
Yeah, in fact, there's an amazing mod for Homeworld or Homeworld 2, which basically kind of turns it into FTL at the same time, where you're actually managing the subsystems of your mothership as well as just kind of rolling it out and controlling production.
Oh, nice!
You're controlling engineers on board, like you're controlling power, shifting power to different systems, and it gives you that kind of micro control. And of course, it's a hard game already, so you've got to fucking know your stuff before you try this. But it's a brilliantly implemented mod, and I can't remember the name of it, but we'll put it in the show notes. Throw a link there.
Cool. Should we do questions?
From questions.
That's usually the place we get them. It's the best place, I think.
Well, not the only place, but the best place. That was almost a Best Coast reference, but no one.
I don't know what that is.
No one got it. Zach writes, "Dear Crate, Wills, and the Royal Baby."
Aww.
Which is quite good. That is quite good. Good job, Neil. Quite good. Introduction to the question. In 30 years, when one of you is a talking head on I Love the Noughties or something, what game will you pick to give tomorrow's children an idea of life in the early noughties? Now remember, Stuart McConey doesn't just go, oh yeah, pogo sticks, they were wicked. He ties pogo sticks into the political, cultural, and economic climate of the time. Does that make sense? Cheers, Zach. I assume does that make sense is not his question. But indeed, the...
Yes, your question is grammatically correct. Next one.
But the rest of that. Now, saying so, answering this requires, in the way that he wants, requires a certain foreknowledge of the future.
Does it?
Well, yeah, because, you know, for example, my answer could be like, well, you'd say, remember Call of Duty? Before the advent of total global war made any such form of entertainment inappropriate. No one really wanted to relive the dark times of, you know, when everyone was sliding off bridges and falling out of cars and helicopters crashed all the time and... you know, your one buddy was like grabbing your hand as he's pulling you back up over the bridge, but then later in the game he died. Like, when that happens, that's happening en masse in real life. That you're not going to be able to enjoy that kind of entertainment anymore. It's too close to the bone.
It's too soon.
I don't know. Maybe I would point to... I don't want to just say Dota. I'm not going to just say Dota. Point to something like StarCraft as a game about clicking on little dudes that ushered in a whole new sport.
I'd pick GTA 4, probably.
Hmm.
I think that's it has some political motivations. I think it's a piece of its time. It reflects a lot of the kind of political angst of the period in which it existed. It also exhibits lots of the flaws of the medium, a lot of the kind of flaws of a nascent medium, and it showcases technology that broke ground and ushered in different genres and... you know, propel games forward. I think it's kind of a significant game in lots of ways.
Are you saying that GTA, the property, is to the noughties what the pogo stick was to the 1970s?
Yes, that's exactly right. A one-to-one match, perfectly.
It's about the same kind of level of threat to the youth, I suppose. Although pogo sticks are actually genuinely more likely to break something.
It's a hard question, really, because most games are completely allergic to commenting on reality in any way, especially politically. So it's like very few games will really comment on the times.
Dota.
But yeah, GTA 4 is a good example, I think.
I think maybe, especially if he's talking about the early noughties and, or like the noughties in general, then there's something to be said for not only Dota, but like those kind of modding communities in general. Because God knows what kind of, like, the what ways the business reality of, you know, we talked about it earlier with Minecraft, but like, that climate will change one way or another. Things are either going to get more open or substantially less. But the specific trend of re-engineering another company's game into a fan-owned thing that then goes on to become a huge sport or this hugely popular thing, that that may well end up being specific to that era, right? It's not someone with great tools making a game from scratch that does brilliantly well, like Unity will allow someone to do. And it's not someone being limitedly creative within an ecosystem that belongs wholly to a publisher.
Yeah, there's also, I kind of think that the modding community that gave birth to Dota and things is the first example of games as service that is now all the rage. But it's just simply leading members of the community servicing that community. And like, Dota is a good example because it was relentlessly updated by custodians who weren't paid for that, but nevertheless they operated in a similar way to a developer might, like Valve might with Dota 2 now.
You wouldn't pick Minecraft then?
Probably have to, but by then, like, I don't know, Minecraft would be everywhere.
Minecraft has a good place in the big kind of Channel 4 3-hour marathon on things people are nostalgic about, because I think a lot of kids will grow up with Minecraft and there'll be an enormous nostalgia around that when we get to this kind of talking head show in the future. So that's the role it'll play. Don't even say much about culture, I don't think. The time it was made.
Paul writes, "Dear Creeps and Meepo and Meepo and Meepo." It's a Dota question, boys.
Yeah.
It's a Dota question. That's why I brought Matt.
Oh, my God. Dota joke. Suddenly started bleeding from the nose.
Why are you just kind of imploding into it?
There's a bit of this for you, Marsh.
Oh, good.
I thoroughly enjoyed the video of Chris casting a game of Dota he played to Marsh, who was playing the role of an audience member, ignorant in the ways of Dota. Marsh wasn't playing a role, I would stress. He was fully method acting the part of man who knows nothing about Dota. Chris having to explain what was going on to someone who didn't understand the intricacies of the game had a net result of explaining a lot about what is cool about the game, something that gets lost in the more professional style casting. I hope you continue to do more of these videos, which there is a plan to do. Now I'm going to skip the part of the question that's directed specifically at me to go to the part that's directed at Marsh, but I will answer the part that's directed at me.
Why don't you do that part first?
Because it's more likely to lead to a longer discussion.
Oh, right, okay.
Question for Marsh. Did the experience of Chris explaining the game increase your appreciation for Dota? Did it make you interested in watching the game more?
I knew more things about Dota, having had things explained to me about Dota, than I did before. Certainly. I don't know if...
You then wanted to learn even more things about Dota?
You were totally up for doing it again.
I'd do it again. But I don't know whether I wouldn't go off and watch a match by myself. I still don't think I'm up to the kind of required level of knowledge where I'd be able to appreciate it.
You know? No, that's fair.
Yeah.
But you seem to like follow the action and kind of understand. I mean, admittedly with me talking about it constantly, but like.
Yeah, I don't think you're not going to be there floating over my shoulder like a little Dinklebot. Telling me
Destiny Dinklebot.
Describing the world to me.
I think I might rename myself Destiny Dinklebot.
That's a good name for a child.
It's like amazing. A child star. Or a stripper.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not relevant to this platform that we play games on, so let's not talk about Destiny Dinklebot. Question for Chris. Would you have any interest in doing casting for pub matches sent to you by Crate and Crowbar fans? If so, what criteria would you look for in these matches? Now, yes is the answer, and we're probably, by the time you watch this, have recorded at least one. I would like to cast more game, like, cast pubs for a bit, sent to me by the community, ideally, because I want to learn to cast properly, because it's something that I like to add to my repertoire of Dota things I can do. And it seems like a good place to start is the Hot Duke Guild, which is available to anybody at cratecrowbar.com/forum. Look for the Dota 2 sub-forum. Matt and I might cast one. Matt, Marsh introduced him as such as the mid laner for the Hot Dukes, which is my Dota team. Recently, sadly, cast out of the Epic LAN qualifiers for the EGX Epic LAN Dota tournament. But we did win.
We did win one.
We did win one.
And we won it well.
We did win it well. We won it well in much the same way as the game I cast with you, Mush, actually. Just
oh, right.
Losing the early game for no apparent reason, and then ultimately learning the true power of friendship, and coming back with mid-game team fights centered on me playing an enormous, slow, boring fish guy who presses R once every 3 minutes.
You pressed it well.
Who that guy is?
Yeah.
Tidehunter.
Yeah.
See, my appreciation grows.
It does, yeah. No, the most boring dire side offlaner, but one of the most effective. So, nonetheless, a good job. In that game, Cox played our elusive mid-weaver.
Nice.
People don't run that hero there often enough.
They don't like mid-weaver, do they?
They don't. We've proven them wrong.
No, I've been flamed in pubs for mid-weaver, and I've never really understood it, because he's great.
He is great. He is a tiny little bug man who can turn back time in much the same way as Cher. But he can't find a place. Anyway, what I would be looking for in a pub replay, like so someone has to send me the match ID so I could find it and download it and load it up to do a replay, to do a cast for it. What I would be looking for is ideally not a stomp by either team, because stomps are boring. By which I mean a game that's over in 15 minutes or like is functionally over in 15 minutes and just the next 10 minutes are just like conflict resolution. It doesn't have to be a game that you win, although I suspect that almost anyone who submits a replay is going to submit a game that they won. But the flip side to that is not a mega long game either. Like, sometimes the best games you'll ever play are, you know, 180-minute slugging matches that end
with... I'm not fucking casting that one.
Exactly. That end with some, like, incredible base race or something. And the point is, they feel incredible to play because you are determining the outcome of that thing constantly the moment by moment you're playing it, and it's a marathon.
Knife edge.
Yeah. It's not a knife edge for people watching it after the fact. It's just a YouTube video that lasts 3 hours. So I think the ideal would be like interesting close fought matches that last between 20 minutes and an hour. Like, that would be the perfect length. But do send them. And no, and skill level really isn't too much of a factor. Honestly, like, I'm much better equipped to commentate on sub 3K MMR games than I am to commentate on games above that. I mean, I can try, but I think I understand the vagaries of sub 3K MMR because I'm a fucking scrub riding around on more talented teammates constantly.
You could manage 4K. We could go up to 4K.
We can't go up to 4K. We are trying to go up to 4K. but no, that's a cool idea, and I'd like to do more of it, so that's why I'll turn to that question. Don't know if we get can cram more Dota chat into this. I'll figure something out.
I'll try.
AJ writes, "Dear Crate and Tengu Tavern, with the recent feature pack that Guild Wars 2 has released, with the stated aim of making the game easier for new players, both new to GW2 and new to MMOs, and its subsequent poor reception in various forums, I was wondering if games are trying too hard to pander to making their games easier and appeal to more players. There are games that thrive on the difficulty, Dark Souls being a prime example, and others that wish to appeal to everyone. Thief, with its wonderful wide array of options in the game's custom difficulty menu, I think he means the Thief remake, actually, allowing you to go from a cakewalk through the game all the way up to we took away your mouse and blindfolded your difficulty. In my personal gaming experience, I've been able to get into Dark Souls, but I love running around in Risk of Rain dying every 5 minutes. I am equally confused by how what Guild Wars did makes the game any easier to play. Anyway, difficulty in games, discuss." So I wasn't really up to speed on the Guild Wars 2 stuff, and I love that game. And that was not a game with a particularly punishing early game for new players at all. No. Like, one of its great strengths is that it scales brilliantly as you play. So I don't really know what
the... You don't need to engage with the difficulty of that game whatsoever to begin with. You can just piss around and go and see nice things.
Not really knowing anything about that, I can't really comment whether it's good or bad. Like, maybe the game did need some difficulty scaling changes because it's a game that gets abruptly harder at level 30. Like, the first dungeon is just, like, disproportionately hard to everything else you've done previously. I suppose my answer to the difficulty thing in general is that, like, there's, I think, a misconception of difficulty where it's almost like a continuum that all games share, where, like, easy is always dumb and hard is always good, is one attitude towards it. And there's the flip side to that, where it's like, Dark Souls is a real game and Peggle isn't.
And Peggle that's can be true. Hard, man. Peggle's hard. You want to get those fucking extreme fevers, you got to work for it.
I'm in a massive quest to get, like, a years-long thing to get the hitting every peg in everything that I've had on my iPod for about 3 years. And I'm on, like, the last 5.
I did that. And then they released it for Xbox and I had to do it all over again on my other console. Terrible addiction. Sorry, you were saying...
But the point is, which you've just illustrated brilliantly, is the difficulty exists in a much stranger, more game-specific way. where even games that are very easy in some ways can have player set challenges in them that make them harder. They can have other ways of approaching them that make them more or less difficult. Variety is not in itself a problem, but degree of variety is something that the game's developers at total discretion to determine for themselves.
Hmm. I think what makes the way that you solve difficulty isn't just by making, it doesn't work well if you just make it, the people do more damage, or, in Thief, for example, from what I've played of it, if you put it on the highest difficulty, it's hard, but it's boring hard. It's they just see you, and then, that's not a creative challenge to solve as such. Best example of this Spelunky is something I've gotten away with talking about for a bit now. It's obviously really hard in that death is everywhere and instant in the spike traps and stuff. And yeah, it takes hours in that. But then, once you've managed it, obviously there's secrets to it. There's a whole other path to another world, without maybe not spoiling Spelunky, in which you make up that challenge. You don't necessarily make it up for yourself, but it's a whole other level that it exists on. And that's the best way of doing difficulty, where you can move on to another stage. And on top of that, which I've just been, recently and just over the course of years, is Spelunky's achievements, which I think is actually a really nice way of adding difficulty and challenge on top of it again. Because Spelunky's achievements are, some of them are your standard, get to here. But then, on top of that, they add, different challenges that are difficult in their own ways, like the speedrun challenge, where you've got to do it in 7 minutes, or the challenge where you don't pick up any gold. And the one where you don't pick up any gold is, that just transforms the way you look at it, because suddenly every speck of gold, which is everywhere, is a spike trap now, and it's just instant death, which is, it's great.
The Dark Souls 1 bro thing, which is beat the game at level 1 and never ever level up. That's a big succession. I think there's a bit of a perception problem around easy modes or concessions to new players. I think it's very rare that those things actually cannibalise the enjoyment of people who are operating at the hardcore end of the scale. So, in Guild Wars 2, I'm not aware of the specifics, but I'd be very surprised if the concessions to new players really affect what you're doing, in terms of late-game dungeons or the PvP or the stuff that you're going to be invested in as a really long-time player of that game. And maybe it might be inconvenient if you're rolling an alt for 20 levels, but once you've blasted through that, I think the net gain for the game in terms of, getting out there to more people and getting more players into that game, which thrives on having more people in it, by the way, is better for you in the long run. This is not based on any knowledge of the specific changes.
But maybe speaking more generally, it all comes down to the type of game. In an arena case with Guild Wars, you touched on it, but Guild Wars is a type of game that is better the more people are in given zones. Guild Wars is event system, and it's public contribution system means that the game is better the more people who are around.
Yeah.
So making the game more accessible is just a way of hopefully feeding a benefit to every player that plays it.
Yeah.
Not every game will benefit directly from greater accessibility in that way. Dark Souls wouldn't.
Yeah.
And they're put next to each other in this email, but they, they have different objectives. Likewise, the Guild Wars business model, the thing that means that it remains subscription free for the people who play it, is based on, selling new copies of the game and getting more people into it. So again, existing players benefit in the sense that that business model that hasn't really been aped anywhere else, apart from Destiny Dinklebot, actually, is one of the only games after Guild Wars to use Guild Wars business model.
The expansions that are paid for, but
So beyond those things, it makes complete sense, I would say, on paper, to do whatever you can to bring new people into Guild Wars at the base level. Yeah. It's a great game. It's the highest score I've ever given a game in PC game, ever.
It is awesome. Apparently, I'm pleased to hear it's doing amazingly well in China as well.
That's awesome.
So they're raking in the bucks.
Good. But to apply all of that same logic to Dark Souls would be a mistake.
Yeah.
And the way to understand that is to difficulty does not exist on a continuum where hardness is of equal value to equal different games.
There's also different vectors of difficulty as well, some of which are fair and some of which are unfair, and Dark Souls has both, and it could do with being less unfair.
Yeah.
Yes.
But probably the ways in which it is fairly difficult are acceptable.
And then there's the other side to this is something like a competitive game, to wit, Defense of the Ancients too, but actually a specific thing and I can bounce this off someone now for once. Has Dota always been hard?
Yeah.
And it's been hard since you were shit at it, and it's still hard now that you're good at it.
Yeah.
And that is because matchmaking functions to a certain degree of accuracy, and, you know, it's a competitive game that does a good job of matching you with new, more complicated things to learn. So when you start, when simply using your abilities correctly seems like the most complicated thing in the world, simply getting your head around 100+ different guys seems like an impossible thing to do. And now you can sit there and it's like, you know, we could just talk for hours, which we won't, just about like all of those heroes, because it's all in muscle memory. Like all of that stuff.
What you're saying, really, it's just that it's on top of that, the heroes on top of that, the items on top of that, the endless little manipulation like of creeps that you can do in the map that like your advantage is.
There's always something else. And so the game is hard, right? Like game is hard is actually a line in the communication wheel in Dota 2. It's one of the things you can slot in if you want to simply express why something might have just gone wrong. Just game is hard. Hard game.
Game is hard. I immediately regret my decision.
Exactly. And like, but that comes from the fact that like game is never easy, right? Like a good competitive game will have that. Like and yet you would want Valve to do everything they possibly could to make Dota more accessible at the bottom level, because again it's a game that directly benefits people coming in. And that doesn't mean making changes to the core content of the game. In Dota that means better tutorials, it means better community stuff, it means whatever, but still, like, accessibility is purely a good thing in that, because it's a game that is never not difficult. It is impossible to master. It's like that guy who beat Dark Souls 1 using a Rock Band controller had continued to find difficulties levels for himself after most of the normal ones. But you can probably fairly say now that if you put a controller in his hands, Dark Souls is no longer hard for him. Right? Like, he's beaten it with a Rock Band controller. Probably not that hard anymore. Whereas you ask Anna Dendi, Dota is hard. Like,
what if there were two people learning how to play Dark Souls on a Guitar Hero controller and they duelled and faced off? That would keep it. That's what he needs.
Yeah, that's why he needs the competition. Yeah, like the last enemy is always other people.
Marsh at this point looks like the end of Indiana Jones and the Ark of the Covenant, where the guy's face just melts and kind of his flesh.
Actually, the Dota talk has been fairly bearable. So yeah,
Interestingly, I think Matt is the first person to speak on the Crowbar who is both really good at Dota and really good at Spelunky. Which means that he's sort of like the natural scion of the two warring halves of this podcast. We can reconcile the ancient rivalry between let's talk about Dota for an entire episode and talk about Spelunky for an entire episode in him, which is great. No pressure. Harry writes, Dear Crate and Crowbar, what features does a game need to be defined as an RPG, and what is the difference between having RPG elements and being a full RPG? Welcome to Semantic Game. Sorry, I added that. More broadly, what features are essential for any genre? Does a wizard 'em up require wizards? When is a game a roguelike, and when is it a roguelike-like? Cheers, Harry.
Weirdly, when I was reading this question, something occurred to me. It's that RPG is no longer really synonymous with a role-playing game at all. Like, I think the two terms
of progression mechanics.
Well, I don't know if it's progression mechanics even. Like, I mean, I think RPG summons a certain kind of stat-based set of mechanics. That's what it suggests to you when you say, it's got RPG mechanics. It's what you're thinking of. You're thinking
probably
you've got
a character sheet. There are probably numbers that tick up. There are probably elements like that you customise.
Yeah, whereas obviously if you say role-playing game, I think just the fact of enunciating those words separately rather than as an initialism actually suggests that you will be role-playing.
It comes from pen and paper stuff, which is where role-playing games came from digitally, from Baldur's Gate, etc.
I don't think you should get too hung up on these things, though.
No,
personally.
I think
it can last a long time.
It's almost a trick, like a bit of a cop out answer, I suppose. But I remember having a really specific argument about this when it came around to refresh the categories for PC Gamers Game of the Year awards, which we'll be rolling around again towards again.
Yeah.
Where like I hated having like best RPG in there and stuff like that, because you know, genre is useful for giving, like, the only reason you have genre terms is so that you can introduce a game in a way that someone maybe understands a few basic tenets of it before you've explained anything specific about the game itself. When genre terms are so useless that they don't actually say anything, like, hey, this is a new RPG, and you really don't know what that means.
Is it Mass Effect?
Yeah. Is it Baldur's Gate? Is it Pillars of Eternity? Is it Borderlands? Like,
Describing Dota to people in a way that makes it sound fun is like the adding, because it's...
Which is why I invented the phrase Wizard 'em up.
Wizard 'em up, yeah.
And does a Wizard 'em up require wizards was a part of the question. No, because I like to believe that wizard is a quality that we can all aspire to in any walk of life. It simply means a certain level of, like, arcane bullshit and, like, a degree of, like, passive but fabulous violence. So, you know, you're not a man knifing another man to death in a gutter. You're not a soldier guy shooting around a corner or breaching clearing a room. There's, like, an esoteric nature to the way wizards fight that is sort of, like, lively and fun and silly, but also sometimes deadly. I love wizards. Anyway. But yeah, no, but you're right. That was why there was a necessity to make a phrase that reflected the tone of the genre itself, right? Like, it's not that the existing language wasn't understood, it's just the existing language didn't reflect something of the world. But that is, like, the reason also that the phrase is that self-consciously silly is because also maybe it is ultimately a pointless argument.
There are games like what the fuck is Watch Dogs? Open world, direction.
Yeah.
What the fuck, really? We just haven't come up with any new phrases.
Aisha Tyler had introduced it as exactly that.
Yes. It's an open world.
The need to categorise is sometimes a bit of a hindrance. Mm. The roguelike is an interesting case because people get really, really upset that the thing that roguelike has come to mean is really permadeath. Or some form of built-in death as need to repeat the game kind of thing. Whereas what they want roguelike to mean is like grid-based maze where movement dictates angle of attack, that kind of thing.
Yeah, who cares about those kinds?
Not rogue exact.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like,
yeah, it's very good.
It's somewhat like rogue.
Yeah.
Not rogue.
And then a roguelike is like the thing that was like rogue. That makes sense to me. That works.
Yeah. Then you get roguelike-ish.
Yeah.
Roguelike-ish-like. Or you could just say it's a roguelike and accept that word, which is a cool word.
Hmm.
Most underappreciated.
Hmm.
Roguelike itself is a cool phrase. Right? Okay. It's fun. It's much better than, like, I don't know what you would call it, like, a PD game for permadeath or something, right?
Permadeath is also kind of a cool term. I imagine explaining either of those terms to your parents, for example. It's a roguelike game, permadeath, and be like, isn't death mostly kind of permanent?
Not in video games.
It's almost never video games.
What it actually means is a loading screen.
I actually had to do this. I did an EPQ qualification thing where I made a game. And at first I had grand aspirations and wanted it to be this sprawling roguelike thing where I had to explain what a roguelike was to like people that had no idea. And yeah, it's a bit mental when you...
It's like Mario.
If Mario dies, you die in real life. There's something to be said for rad language. I would rather have interesting words be used inaccurately, but in a way that people understand, than have boring, really mega-precise, sterile acronyms for everything. To which I say, fuck MOBA.
It's the least, specific term ever, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was a multiplayer online
battle arena. Yeah.
Battle arena, fuck off. I used the term earlier on this podcast, which
so
shows
man.
That it's kind of endemic, isn't it? It's too bad now.
Well, yeah, it's like an RPG, it doesn't mean role-playing game, does it? Yeah. In the same way MOBA doesn't mean what it stands for.
Yeah.
When a word has a set amount of connotations, it's useful. And, it clearly does.
A job, otherwise people just wouldn't.
Mm. Have we survived Semantageddon?
I think we have. We can crawl out from under the rubble of Semantageddon, breathe in the light of a new in the dawn of a new age.
Yes.
Dawn of war, perhaps. Where nothing means anything anymore, and we don't have to worry about having to argue about it.
Or answer any more questions, since there are none.
There aren't any.
No more questions. They're gone. Dead now. You can send us more questions, though, if you wanted to.
Do you?
That's a question you have to ask for yourself.
Yeah, that's
a question. You can ask that question of us, but you'd be asking a question. You would have already answered it. Anyway, you send them to questions@creightoncrowbar.com, or you can do that on the forum, which is www.creightoncrowbar.com/forum, or you can tweet them at creightoncrowbar. Or you can tweet us individually. I'm at Marsh Davis. DAVIES.
I'm at PCG Ludo. which is L-U-D-O, as always.
I'm at C Thurston, C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N.
I'm at Coccyx, which is C-O-C-C-Y-X.
Like the bone.
No, X-X with an extra X, because Coccyx was taken.
Okay. That... Okay.
Yeah.
And with that, we say...
Thanks for listening, everybody. I love rum. Mm. Pardon and a bruising and a pardon away. Oh, she blushes.